Normally, I over-prepare classes. I've got notes for a week, you know, for a half-hour class or something. So I figured I would just kind of cast fate to the wind, and I didn't prepare any notes. Because memory does not work according to dictation. You cannot dictate the workings of memory. There are different, for example, in the field of Holocaust studies, there are different archives. And each archive has its particular purpose. And memory will be reflected differently according to that purpose. I'll give you an example. I received some of my training at the Yale University Holocaust Archive, where before anyone is allowed to speak to a survivor of the Holocaust, they're given months of training. You have to know the subject quite well. Why is that? Because in the hands of a trained testimony facilitator, I don't call it an interview. An interview is different. An interview is where the interviewer is in charge of that experience. All right, there are going to be people coming to interview me today. My expectation is they're going to ask me questions. I have to give them pithy, interesting answers. It's got to be brief. It's got to be to the point. And then they're going to move on to the next question. They're in control of that experience. In a properly conducted testimony, the witness is the expert in his or her experience, and the interviewer is there just to listen. Occasionally, someone who is reliving traumatic memory needs to be guided very gently. Therefore, a lot of training is required. If someone's speaking about the Warsaw Ghetto, you have to know what that is, and you have to be able to ask relevant questions. There are other archives, for example, the Spielberg Shoah Foundation archive, a very important archive. But the purpose of that archive was different. Steven Spielberg decided that he was going to capture on video the testimony of every remaining survivor, and there were about 50,000 in the world. And so time was of the essence. The people who conducted those interviews were given 2 weeks training. That's all the time they had. Most of them were young people. They weren't scholars. And they had a list of questions. Tell us about your life before the war. Tell us something about your life in the camps. And now let's get a photograph of you with your family. So essentially, there's a script there, you know, life before, during, and after the Holocaust period. And the interviewer was in charge of that experience. And there are very, very different results. When you compare those two testimonies, you'll find that given the chance to just be quiet, allow room for silence, will often be the most important motivator to the return of memory. If someone is feeling comfortable with the interviewer, if it's a safe environment, you have to remember that some experiences are so traumatic that people suppress them and never want to talk about them again. So to be comfortable resuscitating those deep memories, it's important that there be a degree of confidence, that there be a comfortable, safe environment. The same is true for trauma victims in rape cases, child abuse cases. People who are trained in these areas know that you have to create a safe arena, a trustworthy arena, in order for there to be some forward movement. So this is a safe environment. And so rather than scripting my memories of Srila Prabhupada, I thought I would allow a more spontaneous dialogue with you. So I'll tell a few stories just as they come to mind. And then I'm going to suggest that we open this up to discussion. No doubt everybody here has some questions that they would like to have asked Srila Prabhupada. Well, I'm not Srila Prabhupada, but I can try to answer as best I can from what I learned from him. So let's see, let's make an experiment here and see what happens, okay? All right. So I'll give you my first encounter with Srila Prabhupada, the first time I met him. It was at the Air India offices on Avenue de la Madeleine, which is a big street in Paris. He had just arrived from Moscow, where he was visiting with Professor Katovsky and made first disciples in Russia. And he had been resting on a bench in the room where there was going to be a press conference. And somehow I had managed to get to the Air India offices ahead of all the other devotees. I don't remember how I did that. And I was sitting outside the door behind which my spiritual master was resting. Now, I had not met Srila Prabhupada. I had been initiated by mail. In those days, sometimes you would just send your request for initiation. I think Mundakini, you and I, and Ilavati, and a few others all received our initiation by letter back then. And you know, you have to send some guru dakshin, some gift to the spiritual master. So we had given everything to the temple when we arrived in Berry Place, so we collected some money, and I remember I bought him some socks. And in his initiation letter to me, he said, thank you very much for the socks, which I have put in my collection for future use. So all that I had had really was a few exchanges of letters with him. And Aradhana, who was one of our good friends from those days in France, came out of the room with a tray. And on the tray was remnants from a snack that they had prepared for Prabhupada. And he handed me a mango peel. So I'm sitting there sucking on this mango peel. Tears are streaming down my cheeks. And I had been a devotee, I guess, about a year or so already. So the door opened, and Nanda Kumar, was that his sir? Nanda Kumar, yeah. So he peeked out, and then he turned back and said, should I let them in, Srila Prabhupada? Well, them was just me at that moment. And this is what I saw. It was the first perfect thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was elegant. It was like a ballet gesture. It was like something choreographed by, you know, some great ballet director. There was no extraneous effort. I don't know about you guys. I sit and I fidget all the time, and I'm scratching and I'm itching and I don't know what to do with my hands. Everything about that gesture spoke to full control, full mastery over his body. And that was it. And I crawled into the room and threw myself down on the ground and sat up because Prabhupada was on the bench. He was in a higher... He was looking down at me, and I'm just looking up at him, weeping. And he looked at me without blinking. Very sober expression. And then all the other devotees arrived and the press conference began. But there was some quite memorable... And many people, you'll speak, every devotee who has a story to tell about their meeting with Srila Prabhupada, and they're all extraordinary. Then... After the press conference was already something else. Somehow there was a gentleman who was head of the Buddhist Institute of Paris who was there. And I don't even know quite how he got invited to this press conference. But Hari Vilas was doing the translating, and so the press were in the room, and they were asking different questions of Prabhupada and then of this gentleman from the Buddhist Institute. And the regulative principles came up, and the Buddha said, well, we don't follow those same principles. We eat meat, and that's not a problem for us. And Prabhupada says to Hari Vilas, what did he say? And Hari Vilas translates. He says that Buddhists eat meat. So I'm sitting behind Prabhupada, and he turns to me, and he gives a little chuckle, and he says, "Here's another rascal." You know? So very quickly, in these first moments of meeting Prabhupada, there was an impression of his personality, his character, his no-nonsense assessment of things. And then afterwards, we went downstairs, and we were waiting for the car to come to take Prabhupada back to the temple. At the time, it was a little suburb of Paris called Fontenay-aux-Roses, and we had a little house there. And we're waiting for the car to come, and Prabhupada is standing on the street. And so Hari Vilas is there, and he... Next door was an outdoor cafe with chairs and tables. And Prabhupada asked, Hari Vilas asked Prabhupada, "Would you like to sit down?" And Prabhupada looked over and he said, "Do they serve alcohol?" "Yes, it's a cafe." He said, "I cannot sit there." He had a standard to maintain and he would not compromise that. So once again, somehow I managed to get back to the temple before everybody else. And Nanda Kumar was cooking Prabhupada's lunch. And he went upstairs, and Prabhupada was in his little room. And he saw me walk by. And then a minute later, I hear, "Jogeshwar." So I come running in. And he's sitting on a cushion like this, and he has his hand in his bead bag. And he's circling his head with a finger. Like he was tracing a thought or something. I have no idea. And then he says, "Throughout my entire life, I have never forgotten Krishna." And then he holds his hand out about this high off the floor. He said, "Even when I was a boy, I had my dolls." He was showing me how tall his Radha Krishna deities, he called them his dolls, were when he was a child. Why that was the first thing he chose to say to me, I've been pondering that forever. You know, was he thinking I had doubts about him or his qualifications to be my guru? Or I think he just wanted to dispel right off the bat that there was any question of his commitment to Krishna and Krishna's mission. That's as close an understanding as I can explain to you. And then the next thing that happened is he says, "Do you see that white, like a little purse almost?" He says, "Open that." So I went over. It was his little carrying case, and he had it, had his toiletries and so on. And inside there was a receipt. And he says, "How much is that?" It was in francs. So it was, "How much is that in dollars?" I said, "Oh, it's about $60. He said, "Yes, they have made me pay this at customs when I came in." He didn't have the proper visas for entering France. So they made him pay a fee for a temporary visa. And I looked at it and I said, "Can you get this money back?" And he looked at me and said, "I don't know." He was very concerned. They had taken this money. And it was a point of discontent for him that they had charged him this money. And then I had prepared a slideshow for him. One of the things that I was doing during the years that I lived in temples was taking photographs all the time. So I had taken photographs of the devotees in Hamburg, where I started, and after London, went to Paris and then to Hamburg, and different newspaper clippings and so on. So I showed him this slideshow, and he had this beatific smile on his face the whole time, just looking at us young people chanting Hare Krishna. And now, looking back, I guess I can understand that he was seeing the fulfillment of his spiritual master's order and the fulfillment of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy. And it must have been a very satisfying moment for him. And then I guess it was a couple of days later, Pradyumna was there and asked me to come with him to the UNESCO headquarters. UNESCO is the United Nations Educational and Cultural Organization. It's a branch of the United Nations that gives endorsement to certain publications, for example, if they are deemed to represent a culture. So Pradyumna wanted to get the UNESCO endorsement for Prabhupada's books. If we got that endorsement, we would have been able to put the UN symbol inside Prabhupada's books, and the UN would buy a certain number of copies for all their libraries and so on. So we went to the office of the UNESCO literary director, and it was a small room filled with books. It was like being inside crammed in a small library or something. And so we talked with him. It didn't work out, whatever the reason was. But as a thank you for having come to see him, he handed me a book of poems by Chandidas and Vidyapati. Now, Chandidas and Vidyapati, who were more or less contemporaries of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, wrote for a very, very elevated category of devotees. Their poetry is about Radha's feelings of separation from Krishna and her anger at Krishna for having abandoned her, and very intimate Madhurya Rasa poetry. So we went back to the house in Fontenelle Rose, and I gave Prabhupada this book and then went to my room to do some service. And a few minutes later, here, Yogeshwar, and I come running in again. And Prabhupada is reading the book of poems. And he says, "Where did you get this?" So I explained. And he said, "You know, we have to be very, very careful. We condemn illicit sex. But listen to this." And he read the following poem by Chandidas. "Harshness at home hurts me like a burn. How long can I bear to be a girl in another's power? It is the sickness of love that has been my disease, and now it is the cure that kills me." So Prabhupada says, now this is a married woman, and she's talking about Krishna. Right? And she's saying that, you know, my love for Krishna is going to destroy me, right, unless I can be with him. And if we publish such poems, people would call us hypocrites because we condemn illicit sex, and then on the other hand, we have such poetry. So we have to be very careful. And then he told me a story. He said that his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj, had gone to his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, with a collection of poems by Chandidas and Vidyapati and requested permission to publish them. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, "No, we can't. This is too intimate. People will misunderstand. So no, I refuse permission to publish these poems." The next day, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati once again returned to his father and said, "I really think we should publish these poems. There's deep philosophy. These are important poems. They're part of our tradition." And again, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, "It's too dangerous. We cannot publish these poems. I refuse permission." The next day, again, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati returned to his father and said, "We must publish these poems." At that point, Bhaktivinoda relented and said, "All right, you may publish. One copy for yourself." And Prabhupada looked at me and he said, "Because where is the Paramhamsa? Where is the great devotee who can understand such deep philosophy?" So here's my first mistake with Srila Prabhupada. He never liked to be praised. So I said to him, "There's only you, Srila Prabhupada." He went like this. I said, "I may not be so great." So I went back to my room. A couple of hours later, Yogeshwar, I come in. And Prabhupada, Nanda Kumara is giving Prabhupada a massage. Now, when Prabhupada got a massage, kind of everything was in motion. You know, it's like, and he's got the book again. Now, this time he's looking at me with this kind of this mischievous little grin, right? And he says, Yogeshwar, what do you think of this? If you really love me, wrap your legs around me. And then he looks up at me like, what are you going to do with that one, wise guy? And I lost it. I just didn't know what to do. I crawled out of the room backwards. I had no idea how to respond to that one. And he was laughing and laughing and laughing hysterically. So, and then I came to him later and said, I don't understand something. In all of your books, there were two books there, and in all of your lectures, right, you encourage us to serve Krishna in the mood of the gopis. You're always saying the gopis' love for Krishna is the highest love for Krishna. Is that really what you want us to do? And he says, oh, that's very nice if you can do that. He said, but to love Krishna that way, you have to be completely free of all material desire. He said, so for now, you should read the books. And he specifically mentioned Chaitanya Charitamrita and Chaitanya Bhagavat. Now, he had not translated Chaitanya Bhagavat. But clearly, he wanted us to expand our knowledge. So while we emphasize Prabhupada's books, it's not that there's some kind of an interdiction on other literature. We're meant to become familiar with Vaishnava literature. So do so carefully. If you're going to read books outside of Prabhupada's work, that's fine. But just be cautious, because not everyone will have the proper depth of commentary to explain things in the right way. Anyway, those are some early memories of those first days meeting with Prabhupada. Any questions? How you doing? All right then. When are you going back to Scotland? Oh, okay. So I'm here to answer your questions, whatever you'd like to ask. I mean, I can tell lots of stories. Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. I don't really have a question, but I just feel really happy listening to what you're saying. Deeply, deeply happy. One of many things you've mentioned was an instance when you walked into Prabhupada's room and he moved in a certain way. Yesterday I was talking to someone about one of my recollections of Prabhupada was that how he would never waste a word. That's been my experience anyway, when he was talking with someone or answering a question. And you mentioned something about the gift of silence at the beginning of your talk. How in that moment of silence, one might be prompted to speak in that space of safety. I was talking to someone about my recollection of Prabhupada, just maybe using one word. And that one word, even the sound of the word coming out of Prabhupada's mouth would be loaded with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, loaded with what? With Krishna, with the spiritual world, with everything.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my recollections of Srila Prabhupada.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just listening to your talk, I'm just feeling almost in the company of Srila Prabhupada. So Thank you very much. And what it's doing for me is unusual as well. It's kind of making me reflect on what have I been doing since those days
yeah.
of being in the company of this
yeah.
person who I think you've just said that you mentioned to Prabhupada, well, you're the only one. And he said, I might not be
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, we were talking about this at Rameshwar Prabhu's house. Thank you. We first-generation disciples live with a lot of sense of guilt. But, you know, we never did enough for him. And we're always yearning to somehow show our love for him. And you don't have quite the energy that we used to have. So how to do that? But your comment about sometimes one word reminds me of an example of that. We were in Prabhupada's room, and one of the American disciples who was doing head administrative work in France was talking about a meeting that we'd had with some church leaders, and saying he was putting them down, basically. He was saying how these church leaders have it all wrong. And Prabhupada said, not wrong, incomplete. That's a big distinction. So be cautious, be very careful. Our role is not to condemn anyone. We don't condemn anybody. We see everyone as spirit souls, servants of Krishna. They forgot. Well, thank you. Yeah. Some other questions or comments? One story while we're waiting for the microphone to make its way over. Silence. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, of secret things I am silence. And we don't do silence very well. And, we're big on, you know, blowout kirtans, and not too big on silence. Right? Prabhupada would often sit silently, listening, as you said, when a guest was present and a guest was trying to ask a question, and sometimes it would be awkward, and sometimes people had some ego. I remember one time in Paris, there was a gentleman who stood up, a room full of people, and he just started pontificating about his knowledge of Sanskrit, and he was quoting verses, and we are all Krishna, and we are all one, and we are Shiva, and we are this, and we are that. And Prabhupada was sitting very quietly, just listening. And then finally, this gentleman quoted a verse from Bhagavad Gita, and Prabhupada went, yes, you have spoken very nicely. And then he went on to say, and then in the next verse, Krishna continues by saying, and this gentleman was so flattered. Here was now you could have just said, let's get him out of the room. You know, he's just taking up Prabhupada's time. But Prabhupada was listening carefully for that opening, for that moment where he could offer some encouragement to this gentleman. So by doing that, by waiting carefully in silence, listening carefully for that moment when there would be some connection, and then he could reel him in, you know, by offering him some appreciation. That was a beautiful technique, if you will. You can call it a technique of some kind, but I think it was more just, that was Prabhupada's way. You know, he respected everyone. But he would do that very often. He would wait till someone would say something that he would connect to Krishna consciousness. Yes, you had a question, Prabhu?
May you share any experiences of how you've seen Srila Prabhupada has the ability to engage people's natures in Krishna consciousness, where he's been very quick to pick up where someone's at and what they're able to do.
Well, of course, the perfect example of that was his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. As soon as he saw Srila Prabhupada, he said, "Why don't you preach Krishna consciousness in the West in English?" So that's the perfect example of that. In terms of recognizing someone's nature and offering them some service according to their nature. Well, yes, he would always do. He would, you know, I remember approaching him with the idea of children's books way back in the beginning. It's 1970 or something. And because, you know, Saraswati, Shamsundar and Malati's little girl was running around, and there were a few children in those days. And I'm asking myself, gee, I wonder, you know, if we shouldn't have some books for children. And Prabhupada said, yes, do it. So I sat down and I wrote a little manuscript called Krishna the Cowherd Boy. It never got published, but he encouraged me. He said, yes, send this to our BBT. I showed it to him. And then years later, I started something called Bala Books, which was a series of children's picture books. And now Mandala Publishing has picked them up, and they've come out with many more Krishna conscious stories for young people. So sometimes he would just, if you had some inclination like that, he would encourage you. Other times he would discourage you. For example, many people went to Prabhupada asking if they could do movies. And he said no. You have any idea the ego that's wrapped up into film work? It's ridiculous. In the peripatetic course of my career, I've had opportunities to go to Los Angeles and kind of seen the film industry from the inside. I mean, here's an entire city dedicated to convincing the world that illusion is real. Yeah. And it's just fraught with ego. And Prabhupada knew that this person or that person, if they got involved with filmmaking, they would just fall down. It would just be an exercise in ego. Other devotees like Yadubara and Vishaka, he would encourage them because he knew that they're professional. They worked as professional photographers before they became devotees. So sometimes it was a very pragmatic issue like that. You know, is this person capable of undertaking this service, or are they going to get into trouble? You know, don't jump up prematurely to some level of service that's going to get you in trouble. You don't want to do that. So be realistic about your level of advancement in Krishna consciousness. If you can do something comfortably, if you can do something even stretching yourself a little bit, that's fine. But if it risks, if it's endangering your Krishna consciousness, then you might fall down, then stay away. So there's a common sense element to that. Sometimes he would just throw us out the door and say, go do it. You know? He threw Gurdas off a train once in India and said, go start a temple. So sometimes he would do that. He threw things at me all the time. He said, take charge of French publications, be the temple president in Paris, take Sankirtan out on the street, do children's books. At one point I wrote him a letter and I said, you've got me doing a dozen things. Which one is the more important? And he said, they're all important. Not that you should not do this because you have to do that. He says, it's a question of your management capabilities. Right. Look at him. Look at his example. He was cooking, leading kirtan, giving class, cleaning. Sometimes he'd get down on the floor and show us how to clean properly. You know, was that Yamuna or... I don't remember he was showing. Huh? That she wasn't brushing the floor. So he got down, you know, hitched up his dhoti and showed her. No, like this. So you have to be expert in everything, I guess, is the point.
Following on this string about Prabhupada sanctioning different types of inclinations. Do you have any recollection of, there's been there any presidencia where Prabhupada would encourage bright devotees, intelligent ones, to take up politics? Because as you see, politics, it's like the power of the world. You know, it could have brought our society to more credibility.
We had a political party one time. Balavanta, who lives in Alachua, is a lawyer. Was running for office, local office. And we have one congresswoman in America now, Tulsi Gabbard, who's the daughter of devotees. And she's quite something. You know, she was head of the Democratic National Committee, and I think she's done two tours of Afghanistan. She was in the military. Very impressive. Generally, though, politics is a real dirty game, and you have to do nasty things to stay in office, and it's a lot of fundraising and, you know, favors that you have to promise people and so on. So he wasn't all that keen on it, you know. If it can be done, okay, that's fine. That's well and good. But generally, if you look at Vaishnava history, devotees were the advisors to the politicians. They weren't the politicians. Right? There were some devotee kings, Maharaj Pratapurudra and so on. But generally, devotees formed the council that would advise administrators how to conduct the affairs of state properly. That's more the role that we're supposed to be playing.
First of all, I want to thank you for this beautiful example of Srila Prabhupada not chastising this person for mm-hmm. all kind of philosophical thoughts which were not in line with mm-hmm. our philosophy, but mm-hmm. actually waiting for the line to come in and unite him with some higher understanding. So, mm-hmm. Jai. That I personally can't hear more of that. You know, I always want to hear more of that. Mm-hmm. I never hear enough. That yes. Srila Prabhupada wasn't a person who will always be on the line chastising and giving the sword.
Yeah, that image of Prabhupada as some kind of lightning bolt is, sure, were there moments like that? Yeah, absolutely. But to typify Prabhupada as being some kind of disciplinarian is a disservice. That was not his way. Why? Then the question arises, why so often do we hear about that side of his nature?
Exactly, yeah.
I have my own theory about it. When we confront strident behavior in our society, whether it be emphasizing the, you know, kick on their faces with boots kind of mentality and smash and, you know, words like that, very aggressive language. My impression that I get is that people will find any excuse they can grab to avoid the real work of becoming a devotee. To become a Vaishnava is no small thing. It means that you have to strip away ego, you have to be humble, you have to actually respect people. And that can be intimidating. You know, we've built up a lifetime of defenses, you know, to keep people out. We don't want them to know what we really are like, you know. So whether it's a poison theory or other ideas about initiate, whatever it may be, all kinds of excuses for actually doing the hard work of cleansing the heart, all of the things that are waiting to be cleansed away in there. And you have to ask why that's so, because if you don't, you'll just get angry. When devotees, especially devotees in positions of authority or responsibility, behave in that kind of, you know, bull-headed, you know, Winston Churchill, whatever thing, that, you know, you can get angry, you can get frustrated over that, and some people go away, you know. Some people become Ritvik because they've been insulted and put down by somebody, you know, within ISKCON. So they, well, it's not, I can't deal with that, so I'm going to go someplace else. We're complicated creatures. After leaving temple life, after 13 years living in temples, I went to see a psychiatrist. And she's a very smart woman. And she wrote a book called How to Overcome the Fear of Success. Now, that sounds counterintuitive. You would think, well, no one's afraid of success. We're afraid of failure. No. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of her name was Martha Friedman, and one of her clients was a very well-known songwriter, an award-winning songwriter, and she brought this gentleman to her class at Columbia University where she was teaching, and he did a turnaround on her. He told her students right off the bat, he said, "Don't believe what Martha's telling you about fear of success. My worst song won a Grammy Award. I love being a success." So one very insightful young woman in the class raised her hand and said, "Did you always want to be a songwriter?" And he said, "Well, when I was younger, I wanted to play piano for a living." "Why didn't you do that?" she asks. And he says, "Well, my family was very poor. And there was just more money to be made in writing songs. So," she asks, "now you're a big success. Why don't you go and do what you wanted to do?" And he said, "You know, it's funny. Whenever I've tried to give up songwriting and just play piano, somehow I managed to burn my fingers." All right. Now, this is what's called self-sabotaging behavior. Subconsciously, if I were to go back to becoming a piano player, he's thinking, I would be harming my parents. I would be taking food off their table. Or another example that Martha gave, there was a woman who came to her, and in therapy, this woman described that she always wanted to finish her college degree, but she never manages to go back and finish her degree. So in the sessions, it turned out that she was one of two daughters, the elder of two daughters, and that her younger sister was not a very good student, but she was always an A student, you know, top grades. And her parents, bless their hearts, would say in front of both their children, "Well, at least one of our children turned out okay." So when this woman wanted to go back and finish her college degree, she was unable to do so because unconsciously it was going to be at the price of putting her younger sister down once again. Right? Or a child of alcoholic parents will very often think, "If I was a better child, maybe my parents wouldn't drink as much." You know. So we carry these behaviors over from early life into our Krishna conscious careers, you know, and our behavior is influenced by these early experiences. You know, just because we have some intellectual idea about Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan doesn't mean that somehow the human psyche has now become resolved and everything is easy. You know, all of our neuroses have just magically disappeared, you know, because I'm chanting on my beads. I'm sorry, that's just not quite the case. And I don't know, I go out a little bit out on a limb with some of these theories here, but I don't know whether it's actually possible to make really strong progress in Krishna consciousness without confronting who we are. What's brought us to this point? And why we behave as devotees the way we do. So some of that, this is a long answer, but some of that strident kind of, you know, macho blah, 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 it's a hangover from childhood. It's not Prabhupada. It's something else that they're dealing with, some problem with authority or whatever.
On the other hand, how did Srila Prabhupada deal with arrogance and with which I'm 100% sure he had a lot of chances to do that. So what was his I mean, of course, it's very individual, but you know, have you witnessed something
like
that?
Oh my goodness, yeah. Well, you know, when necessary, he was a lion. He was a tornado. He was a volcano. I remember at Berry Place one time. In those days, Indian people would come to the temple, and some of them were a little proud of the little bit of knowledge they had. Now, there was one Indian gentleman who started quoting all these verses about how we're all, you know, Shiva is the supreme being, and I don't know what he was saying. Prabhupada was sitting on the Vyasa's side. And his face was getting red. He's like, it's getting. And then when the man was done, Prabhupada, like a Gatling gun, he was firing verses at him. Boom, 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 boom. And this man was literally backing up till he was against the back wall of the Berry Place temple. And he slid down to the ground. Like, and then Prabhupada says, "Have you understood now?" And the man says, "Yes, I've understood." "All right, then." And I looked up at Prabhupada, and I was like shaking my head like this, and he looked at me and went. When necessary, he could be quite strong. I mean, if anyone was offending Krishna, my gosh. Or his disciples, even. If someone said something bad about his disciples, he was very strong about that. These people are trying to understand God. How you were saying this about them? You know, he was very, very protective in that way. So, yes, when justified, he never held back. He'd be very strong. He could yell. Sometimes he would even yell. You know, but you never felt insulted. If Prabhupada yelled at you, you felt cleansed. You know, he would say, "Why don't you understand? You know, don't you see how hurtful this is?" And you, "Oh my gosh, yes, that would make dangerous."
But what's your understanding? Why did people, like, for example, you mentioned this macho culture where aspiring devotees allow themselves to actually do that.
Do what? Yeah, I'm sorry?
Yell and speak with a very angry and diminishing tone to other people. So why, and people do get offended, as you mm-hmm. mentioned, some people might leave or go somewhere else because mm-hmm. they don't feel respected or welcome. Mm-hmm. So, but how did Srila Prabhupada get away with that? What do you believe? What was the difference? Because the same words can come from the mouth of a person and have a completely different impact.
We were never meant to imitate Prabhupada's personal style. That wasn't the idea. When you say follow in the footsteps, it doesn't mean you give class by closing your eyes and imitating a Bengali accent. Yeah. I mean, follow in the footsteps means to understand the teachings and to present the teachings and know the standards. Anyway, we could have a longer discussion about this, but thank you for your question. Are there other questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu? Mm-hmm. Well, take the microphone if you would. When does this class end, by the way? 8:30? Okay.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu. I was just wondering, in terms of our personal development of Krishna consciousness, how much emphasis should we put on, for instance, preaching, distributing books, all the external activities? And how much emphasis should we put on trying to develop our own Krishna consciousness, trying to emulate Prabhupada's, Prabhupada's example of how he dealt and how he behaved in Krishna consciousness? Are they sort of symbiotically related, or are they separate? Or
if I understand your question, you're asking, how do we strike a balance between external activity and internal activity?
Well, it's just a system. We get encouraged from the joint movement to engage in the
conversation. Sorry, I can't quite hear you.
Sorry. We get encouraged when we join the movement to engage in the external activities of Harinam Sankirtan, book distribution, preaching. But there's not a lot of emphasis given, at least many years ago, I'm not sure now, but so much emphasis given on an internal development. So you were talking a little bit about how we come with behavioral patterns and conditioning from our childhood. So in Bhagavad Gita, in the towards the end of the third chapter, Prabhupada says that we have to identify enemy. He's referring to lust and Aranathas. We have to identify, become aware of them, and then overcome them, Anatha Nivritti. So how much emphasis should we put on our own internal development?
Okay, all right. First of all, let me take slight exception to what you're saying. I would not characterize book distribution as something external. It's only external if you approach it in that way. You know, if you're doing it with, you know, gritting your teeth and hating every minute of it, then it's external. If you've captured the mood of book distribution, if you understand the privilege, the great honor of being able to distribute Srila Prabhupada's books, then it's internal work. And it can be that source of spiritual inspiration that I think you're referring to. So a lot of it has to do with attitude. You know, how are you approaching the service you're doing? And don't get me wrong, I'm not recommending that everyone go run off now and find a psychiatrist. That's not my, you know. By the way, Prabhupada sent one of his own children to a psychiatrist. I don't know whether you're aware of that. I asked him one time, in Paris, I said, what do you think of psychiatry? And he said, well, one of my sons came back from college and he went like this, he wasn't right in the head. And so in Calcutta in those days, he said the hospital had two wings. There was the British wing and the Indian wing. And I paid a lot of money to send my son to a psychiatrist in the British wing. And for a while, he said, it helped. He was more normal. But then he left home again, and I never saw him again. So he says, I don't have, you know, complete faith in it. But he was willing to try it. You know, when you have a toothache, you go to the dentist, right? You're not expecting enlightenment. All you want is to get the darn cavity filled. And we're pragmatic about this. Sometimes the mind has, you know, a cavity that needs to be filled. So you may go to a doctor for that. It's a pragmatic thing. It's not like some, you know, now I must be doubting my Krishna consciousness if I'm seeing a shrink. So it's a matter of, I think, the way you approach your service and being honest about it. Why would cheese on toast be late? I don't understand.
They can't cook a batch, they have to do it.
I see. It takes longer to do it all. All right, so it's a cheese on toast class here. We'll go late. Was there, Ilavati, did you want to say something?
When I came here yesterday, all the devotees were reading or reciting or plainly creating right on the spot their tribute to Srila Prabhupada. And I don't mean any offense to that devotee, but there was a devotee, I don't remember his name, you know. So that's what I mean. Please forgive me for not remembering your name, Prabhu. He talked about Srila Prabhupada, the movement being carrying on, and Prabhupada's fame being, still very prominent 1,000 years from now. And you talked about seeing a young person telling you that he was from the sixth generation of devotees, which is completely amazing to me, you know. Anyway, this is more a comment than a question, sorry. But the whole crux of the matter is the transmission of knowledge. And I would like to thank you very much, not so much by what you, the words you use and, you know, the stories, the storylines that you gave, but just the person you are. And this, the person that you are is what making possible a real transmission. And it answers a lot of the question that everybody, because Krishna is the supreme being, and it's only by being the where Prabhupada was that we can allow the transmission process to. So thank you very much, Prabhu.
Thank you very much. I was going to ask you to tell us the story again about the mayor of Paris when he probably wouldn't stand up, because that's a very nice story. Remember that story?
I'll tell it to you over cheese and toast later.
I'm not taking cheese and toast. All right, later, fine.
Anyone who wants to hear the mayor of Paris story, let's sit down together over cheese and toast and I'll tell the story again. The ironic part about that moment was that at the very same time that Prabhupada was being received in City Hall by the mayor of Paris, Indrajimna and the Sankirtan devotees were being arrested for soliciting without a permit. So you have this, you know, we've been a movement of extremes, you know, at sometimes completely vilified and at other times exalted to the highest levels. That's kind of, I guess, how it's always been. People don't know how to respond to us. Should they hate us? Should they love us? Who knows? So we have to just push on.
I have another question. What did the psychologist say about you after being in the temple for 50 minutes?
What did she have to say about me? Well, a good psychiatrist won't pass judgment on anyone. Their job is to provoke, with the right kinds of questions, realizations that a patient can come to on his own or her own. So it wasn't a dictating of, you know, this was good or this was bad. It was on more the nature of inquiry, which is what a good teacher does. A good teacher doesn't always tell, do this, do that, but rather provides a path for a student to explore and find his or her own direction. So the answer to your question is that sometimes Prabhupada would suggest that someone do something, but he was there to encourage people. You know, if someone had a particular inclination, then he would try to encourage them. Sometimes discourage if he saw that they were just off base.
Prabhuji,
yes. What does that mean? That the class is over now? Well, in the interest of sticking with the schedule, I think we'll end class now. And thank you very much. And if anyone would like to talk, I'm happy to talk with you outside. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.